which is my book, this one. When You Greet Me, I Bow. I don't know if you've seen it, but Shambhala wanted to put my picture on the cover, and I didn't want them to. So we compromised. We got half my picture. It's a collection of essays. They didn't want to publish it at first because they said nobody wants to read a collection of essays. You know, people want to read books that have a theme, you know, throughout. And this is a grab bag of many different kinds of things. And it's pieces that I've written over a period of 30 or 40 years, because I've been publishing in the Buddhist magazines essays about Buddhism for a long, long time. And so Cynthia Schrager from our Sangha in the Bay Area she's got her doctorate in literature, so she's a really astute reader of texts, and she is the editor of this book, and she's really the one who's more responsible for it than I am, actually. She hunted down all these texts. Many of them, you know, were published before the internet days and before computers were what they are now. So in order to find them, she had to go into the attics of editors of now defunct publications to find them. And she did that. And she put them all together, and she selected some that she thought would be worth reprinting, because this is not all my essays. This is just the ones that she selected. And then she put them into categories and themes, and she said, look, you've been thinking about these same things for all these years. These are the things that you've been thinking about, and I didn't really realize that until she pointed that out to me. She made four baskets for the essays. She felt like they were more, these are the things that I've been thinking about for all these years. One is relationship, and its connection to Dharma. Another is the emptiness teachings that are so central to Mahayana Buddhism, and that have, in particular, have for some reason always appealed to me from the very beginning of my practice, when I didn't understand these teachings at all. Not that I understand them too well now, but in the beginning I just had no idea what they were about, but I was intrigued by them and moved by them. So it's been a constant theme in my practice. The third basket is cultural transmission, because a lot of people think, you know, that I was a student of Suzuki Roshi. But actually, I wasn't. I never met Suzuki Roshi. He was alive when I first started to practice, but I'm so allergic to teachers and gurus that it never even occurred to me to go up, try to meet him or go to where he was. You know, I was uninterested in that. I really didn't like following gurus. I thought, I have enough problems on my own, you know, why do I need to take up somebody else's idea about who they think I am, you know? So I never met Suzuki Roshi. So I was very aware of the fact that I was studying Buddhism with Western teachers in the West. And I was aware that this was a tradition that was not a Western tradition. So it's all these years I've considered this. We are trying to do this in the West, and that's really a big deal, because, boy, the West is pretty different from the East. And not only that, it's increasingly less different from the East, of course, as time goes on, but the Buddhisms that we've inherited from the East all come from a feudalistic period in the East. All the teachings assume kings and royalty and principalities, and there's no such thing as democracy or human rights. Those concepts don't exist in the Buddhist teachings. So I've been aware of this adaptation and how how it works and doesn't work. So that's been another basket of my concerns, cultural transmission. And the fourth is engagement, that our practice is not an escape from reality, although it gives us great respite from the craziness of the world. But it's not meant to be an alternative to the craziness of the world. It's meant to be a way of fully engaging our lives in the present world as they are, giving us a new way to understand the world and our place in it. So those have been the four concerns that I guess have been my major concerns: relationship, emptiness teachings, cultural transmission, and engagement. And those are the four sections in the book. And then I thought I was going to get away with doing no work at all, and Cynthia was going to do all the work, you know, for the book. But then she said, "No, I think you should write some new stuff." And I said, "Oh, no, you know, I don't want to write new stuff." And she said, "No, here's what you should do. You should write notes. You should read each section. And then you should write notes reflecting on those things that you wrote long ago. So you won't have to write like finished, you know, pieces with themes. Just write notes about these essays." So I said, "Well, that's pretty easy. I can just improvise, you know, write this very quickly." So that's what I did, and that's why the book is called Notes and Reflections from a Life in Zen, because it includes notes that I wrote at the end of 2020. When we were already in the pandemic and in the thick of the Trump moment here in the United States, which is infamous all over the world. I know you remember that the United States did have a president, Trump. You probably heard about that, and he was really something.
Excuse me, Norman. Sorry to interrupt. There's quite a hiss or sound coming through since you started speaking. I'm just wondering if you had changed your mic setting in some way, or perhaps turned on or put off original sound. If you can't change that.
You know what? It's original sound. I put the original sound on for the bells, and I've taken it off now. That's probably what it is. Is it better now?
Yes, much better. Thank you.
Sorry about that. I have to always remember to put it on. But I don't need to repeat anything I said, right?
No.
You heard it. Because I don't even remember what I said. Anyway, let's see. Yeah, so I wrote notes for each of the sections, and that was fun to do. Then I could, because you know, this is the thing about writing. You could say something really stupid that you thought 30 years ago, and now forever and ever you're responsible. That thing you said 30 years ago that you didn't even believe at the time. You know, you only believed it in the moment that you wrote it. And now 30 years have gone by. And that's the trouble with, so don't ever become a writer. Have your things in print. Write all you want, but don't put it in print. Because then all these distortions are going to happen. Anyway, I wrote these notes on all these sections. Anyway, I want to start off by reading for you a couple of stories that appear in the very first essay in the book, which is the title essay, "When You Greet Me, I Bow." And that phrase comes from one of these stories. And so this is an essay about relationship. And to talk about relationship a little bit this morning, I'm going to share these traditional stories. So here's one of them. Here's the first one. Long Tan made rice cakes for a living. But when he met the priest Tian Huang, he left home to follow him. Dan Wang said, "Be my attendant. From now on, I will teach you the essential Dharma gate." So after a year, Long Tan said to him, "When I arrived, you said you would teach me. But so far, nothing has happened." And Long Tan said, "What have you been teaching me?" And Tian Huang said, "When you greet me, I bow. When I sit, you stand beside me. When you bring tea, I receive it from you." So that's the story. And this is very familiar to me because my own teacher, who died just 1 year ago this month, taught me like that. You know, he never taught me anything. And I remember once I said that, either I said it publicly or I said it to him, I said, "You never taught me anything." And I meant that in a really positive way, but he got a little mad at that. And then later he calligraphed a rakasu for me, and on the back of the rakasu it said, "I have nothing to give you but my Zen spirit." So I think that's it. You know, there's nothing to teach, but there is a spirit living that you somehow get over time. You know, in our relationships, in the practice, it's not an abstraction. Here's another story. One day, while Guishan was lying down, Yangshan came to see him. Guishan said, "Let me tell you about my dream." Yangshan leaned forward to listen. Guishan said simply, "Would you interpret my dream for me? I want to see how you do it." In response, Yangshan brought a basin of water and a towel. Guishan washed his face and sat up. Then Xiangyang came in. And Guishan said, "Yangshan and I have been sharing miracles. This is no small matter." Xiangyang said, "I know, I was next door and I heard you." Guishan said to him, "Why don't you try?" And Xiangyang made a bowl of tea and brought it to him. Guishan praised them both, saying, "You two students surpass even Shariputra and Moggallana with your miraculous activity." And Shariputra and Moggallana were historical early disciples of the Buddha, close disciples of the Buddha. So these are two stories about relationship in the Dharma. They're beautiful stories, but probably mostly, at first blush anyway, they're a little baffling because they don't express what we would be thinking about when we think about relationships. Usually, in relationships, one way or the other, we're after something. Our relationships fulfill a need for us. Just the simple need for human contact, for friendliness, for being a person next to a person. You know, we all need that. We don't want to be alone. Even people, of course, people differ in how gregarious or social they are. There's a great range. But even someone who's very solitary needs some kind of human contact. And we think of relationships as getting to know each other, you know, getting to know our stories, where are you from, and what matters to you, and what have you been through. And but these stories that I read to you have nothing like that in them. It almost seems like do these people even have relationships as we understand relationships? One of the ideas, thoughts, that has been really important to me in my understanding of this over the years has been the great teaching of Martin Buber in his classic book, I and Thou. It's a profound book, and I can't do justice to it, but more or less, Buber makes a distinction between two kinds of relationships, because I and Thou is all about relationship. He makes a distinction between two kinds of relationships. He calls them, an English version anyway of what he calls them in German, is I-it, I-slash-it, and I-slash-thou, or I and it, and or I and thou. And I and it is a relationship that is instrumental and transactional. We fulfill each other's needs. I have a need and you fulfill it, you have a need and I fulfill it, therefore we are in relationship. And so when that is no longer the case, you know, when you no longer fulfill my needs, or I yours, then our relationship is broken. And Buber says that most relationships in the world are of necessity that way. You know, I go to my baker because I want to buy a loaf of bread, and that's the basis of that relationship, and that's reasonable and good. And we have most of our human relationships are like that, and that's not a sin or a problem or something wrong with that. That's necessary. Because we do have needs. We do need bread, and we do need friendship, and we do need a sounding board for our lives. But there's another kind of relationship, Buber says, that is less common and probably more fundamental, more important to our humanness, and that's the I-thou relationship. In the I-thou relationship, we do not fulfill each other's needs. We just fully enter into intimate relationship beyond our human needs, beyond our personalities, beyond our longing, beyond our wounds. We remain different beings. I'm I and thou is thou, you know. We don't merge and disappear in some way. But at the same time, we do merge and disappear. So in the I-thou relationship, we enter into a larger space of our living. We enter into relationship beyond our needs, beyond our stories, beyond our personalities. We throw our lives away in the midst of that encounter. And that idea of Buber's really has helped me to understand these Zen stories, because I really do think that these Zen stories are about an I-thou relationship and our relationship to our teachers and ultimately to all sentient beings and to ourselves. In the practice is that kind of relationship. It's not that we leave I-it relationships behind, because as long as we're alive, we are human beings, we have needs, so we don't go beyond or throw away those relationships. But at the same time, we recognize that underlying them is this other kind of relationship where we fully meet each moment and each thing and each person in each moment beyond our stories, beyond our self-interest. And this is something that I say is perhaps unknown to many of us, completely unknown, because we so much live on the level of I, it, on the level of needs and desires and personalities, that we almost don't even recognize there is anything else. And nowadays, you know, when you think about it, the scientific materialistic worldview, which all of us share, if we live in these times, it is always about instrumental living, right? It's about data and problems and solutions to objective problems. Even being a human being is like that. We can study the brain and we see, the brain needs this and that, so we need these things. Psychology becomes science by definition, objective, meaning not intimate. So many of us don't even know, I've never thought about this, but in Zen practice, it's the most important thing. Nowadays, we're so aware of our stories and our personalities. And, you know, there's a great need for all of us to tell our stories. So, like, it used to be that in public life, you didn't know the story of somebody, you know. But now, everybody's story is known and written about. We want to know, you know, what our past was, and where we're coming from, and what our wounds are. Confessional is now commonplace. There are no secrets, right? Everybody needs to reveal everything about who they are. And then now, identity, politics is so important now, right? We can't look at something without considering the identity behind it. The stories are so important nowadays, whether you're a man, a woman, gay, straight, non-binary, what race you are, what culture you come from, because these things have been suppressed. And the normative story was always told by the white male. We now realize we have to balance that with many other stories. So that's makes sense. And it is important. Why is it important? Because there has been, as we now know, oppression in the past that was pretty unconscious. At least some people were unconscious of it. So now we're correcting that. So that's good. But at the same time, there's something for any one of us, no matter what our identity, there's something beyond our identity, our history, and our woundedness. In the Dharma, the word intimacy is often used as a tool for awakening, for the goal of the practice, to become intimate with all things. Never to be separate. Never to define ourselves as over against things. That's to be awakened, right? To be in identity with whatever is in front of you, whether it's another person or a leaf or a twig. So we have these two sides, right? The side of identity, history, linear time, inside of the absolute, intimacy, non-hierarchy. Hold on a second, I've got to get a drink of water. My throat is itchy. Anyway, right away you think of these things in a hierarchy. You have two things, one must be more important than the other, right? Somebody might say, well, okay, forget about this intimacy and blah blah and all that, you know, I got problems, I got a mortgage, I'm busy, I don't have time for that, it's not important. Then you have the other person who says, no, you know, this is religion and spirituality. This is way more important than the triviality of crazy life. Maybe we Buddhists think that it's our practice is much more important than, much more profound, much more real than the passing fancy of every moment. Objective life. But the Dharma proposes that there is no hierarchy between these two things, that they are in fact the same. They're not two different things. That they're one thing. And that's, in a way, the koan of our lives, the koan of the arising of every moment, and the koan of Buddha Dharma. That is the fundamental koan, isn't it? Every moment we are these particular beings, and every moment we dissolve into everything. And that's our human life. And we have to take care of all of it. And that's why, in a way, Zazen is so great. Because when we sit in Zazen, we are sitting in the middle of that koan. And it's clear and perfect in our sitting. No matter what's going on in our sitting, we're sitting right in the middle of that human predicament. So this, I think you can understand how this paradox is in the middle of our human relationships, because if human relationships are difficult, and we know that they are, right? Difficult to be. I mean, you know, my relationship with the guy, the baker, is not too difficult, right? I buy the bread, I pay the right price. I say hi, he says hi, she says hi, everything's fine, not a problem. But my relationship with my children is not quite so simple, or with my spouse, or with my close friends, or with the government. Right? Human relationships are really difficult and painful and tragic. I mean, in the end, right? What is a horrible war but the complete breakdown between two groups of human beings, right? Who decide that it makes a lot more sense to kill hundreds of thousands of people then figure out how to get along. It's, when you think about it, it's stunning, right? How could there ever be a war? How could anybody ever kill anybody? How could that be? And yet, actually, it's stunningly common. It's really common. Because And the relationships are really difficult. I am me. I need this. You are in my way. I can't have that. Right? That happens in big ways and small ways all the time. So right in the middle of this paradox of human relationships come the emptiness teachings. The emptiness teachings are all about this paradox. All about these two sides of our being human, neither one of which really and truly can be avoided. We can forget about one, but really only at our peril. All dharmas are marked by emptiness. They do not increase or decrease. They are not tainted nor pure. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form, the Heart Sutra says. And isn't that the paradox right there? Isn't that the koan right there? There's no emptiness. Right? Emptiness is form. No emptiness. You know, like this thing, this concept, this experience called emptiness, there is no emptiness. Emptiness is form. That's what it says. It's pretty clear. You want to know what emptiness is? It's form. But what's form? Form is emptiness. And as you know, form just doesn't just mean form, it means everything. It means emotions, feelings, desires, perceptions, everything. What are those things? They're all emptiness. But what is emptiness? Emptiness is those things. Buddhism, as you know, is not proposing another world. It's proposing another world right here in this one. This comes out in another way of looking at it. On the one hand, the compassion of the Bodhisattva to help, to care. Practically speaking, you need, you're cold, here's a blanket. You're hungry, here's a sandwich. But all dharmas are empty. There's no sandwich, there's no person over there. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. There are no beings. So there's no pressure. There's no desperation. There's no guilt. Take that Hans poem. You want to save the world? Smile. Be happy. And save the world. I don't know if any of you remember who Paul Reps was, but Paul Reps was one of the early people who, ages ago, more than half a century ago, introduced Zen into the West, and he used to make little drawings with captions, and one of them, I remember, that was made into a broadside, and we would see it hanging on people's walls. It said, it was like a drawing of a teacup, and it said something like drinking tea, I end the war. Something like that. I'll read you a few pages from another section of the book called This is from an essay called Beautiful Snowflakes. When the first time I encountered the word in English, I liked the sound of it. Emptiness. Some would find it chillingly abstract, even scary, but I took to it immediately. I chanted the Heart Sutra alone and with Sangha every day for years and years before I ever bothered to find out what the great teachers of the past meant by emptiness. It didn't matter to me what it meant. Somehow I knew what emptiness was. I thought, anyway. Of course, I didn't. But somehow I did. I remember once, at the very beginning of my practice, long, long ago, on a break in a month-long retreat in upstate New York, wandering around in the woods during a blizzard, drifting snow piled 2 feet high, covering everything, chanting the Heart Sutra over and over again as I walked. In the snow, with trees, bushes, and ground covered in white, 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 and the sky white, with whiteness falling down onto my head, the sutra's meaning was perfectly clear. It wasn't until much later that I plunged into the philosophical by Kathy's going somewhere. I plunged into the vast philosophical edifice of Mahayana Buddhism from the Diamond Sutra and Nagarjuna on that elucidates the saving and elusive teaching. And I still have studied those texts many, many times. And every time I do, I'm just so happy just reading the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra, Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines, 100,000 lines, Nagarjuna's verses from the middle. The logic of emptiness is absolutely airtight. Like all simple truths, its clarity is immediately self-evident. We are. We exist. And this means that there is no moment in which we can be separate and apart. No moment in which we can be torn from the fabric of reality. We are always connected. Past, future, to others, to objects, to air, to earth, to sky. Every thought, every emotion, every action, every moment of time has multiple causes and reverberations, tendrils of culture, history, hurt, and joy that stretch out mysteriously and endlessly. And as with us, so with everything else, all things influence one another. And this is how the world comes to appear. It appears, shimmers, shifts, moment by moment. But if things always associate with and bump up against each other, that means they touch each other. And if they touch each other, they must have parts, for without parts they couldn't touch. They would just simply dissolve into one another. But the parts are also things in their own right. The nose, for example, is part of the face. But it's a thing, a nose. An airplane wing is part of an airplane, but it's a thing, it's an airplane wing. Therefore, each part must have parts. Nose has nostrils, right? Airplane wings have wingtips. So those parts must also have parts. You see where this is going. An infinite proliferation of parts. clouds of them. Which is true, not only in Buddhist analysis of reality, but also in physics. In other words, if you look closely enough and long enough at anything, disappears into a cloud that disappears into a cloud. All is void. There is no final, substantial anything anywhere. The only thing real is the connection, the void touching the void. So impermanence does not mean, as we think it means, something exists, but only for a while. It changes and then it's gone. No, it doesn't exist at all. Because as soon as it appears in a moment, in that very same moment, it disappears. And then, because of momentum, another moment comes and it's there again, but it disappears again in that same moment. So impermanence really is emptiness. There is no impermanence of things because there are no things. And this is a delightful teaching. It's not really, you know, an idea. It is a way of thinking and understanding this life. It is peerless. It is impossible to confute because in the end it proposes nothing and denies nothing. Appearances remain valid as appearances. If you say, well, emptiness is saying we're not here, but we are. No, emptiness is not saying we're not here. Appearances remain valid as appearances, and there is no reality beyond appearances other than the emptiness of the very appearances. So there is nothing to argue for or against. Because emptiness is paradoxical. So what kind of argument could you make against it? In being empty, everything is free of argument. Everything is lighter than air. But it is the taste of emptiness in the body, in the spirit, in the emotions that has meant the most to me. Knowing that what happens is just what happens. My body, my thoughts, my emotions, my perceptions, desires, hopes, actions, words. This is my life. And it is never desperate because I feel its cloud-like nature. And this cloud is all that I am. And I can fly in it. Float in it and watch it form and reform in an endless sky. This does not mean that I'm living a disconnected Buddhist life of disassociation and nirvana. It's the opposite. Because I know there is no way that I cannot be connected. Every moment I have to be connected. There's no way out of that. I can't go in my room and shut the door and be gone. I'm always connected. There is no place in the world and no person on earth, no being on earth that is not within the circle of my concern. So when I practice Zazen, I step into emptiness. My breath is coming and going. And this breath that's coming and going, I'm literally sharing with every creature on earth. Not only creatures who are alive now, but every creature who has ever lived is in my breath. There's on the Facebook circulating a quotation from Thich Nhat Hanh. Maybe you've seen it. Where he says, when I'm gone, don't build a stupa for me. If you have to build a stupa for me, it should say on it a sign, I'm not in here. But I'm not out there either. I am in every breath you take. That's true. When we breathe in and out in sitting, it's not you meditating. I mean, yes, it's you meditating, but not really. It is the great rhythm of physical reality that never ceases. Even when the earth is burnt to a cinder, that breath is still there. It's so nice in the pre-dawn hours to sit sharing that widely, knowing that this zero point underlies all my walking and talking and eating and thinking and doing. Every activity of mine is this every day, my whole life through. They say that wisdom, which means in Buddhism, wisdom means the faculty that cognizes emptiness. Wisdom and compassion are like the wings of a great bird. Holding both in balance against the wafting winds allows you to float, enjoying the day. But really, there's only one wing. Where you can appreciate the flavor of emptiness on the tongue, you know immediately, without mediation. Which is what immediately means, right? Without mediation. You know that love is the only way things go. Everything, everything is love. What a nice thought to hold in mind as you sit. That all the problems, all the disasters, all the joys, all the sorrows, it's love. That's what it is. And that's what emptiness tells us. So I will stop there. I've talked a lot. What's wrong with me? I just talk all the time. Let's take a short break, and then when we come back from the break, let's discuss in groups. Okay, in other words, if we take a 10-minute break now at 10:35 and come back at 10:45, we'll have from 10:45 up to noon for small groups and whole group discussion and maybe a little sitting before we break. Okay? So.